Okay, well, first of all, I want to say thank you to Dan for pitch hitting for me last week and covering some topics that are not easy to do, you know. I mean, the Greek Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church, differences, similarities, and also dealing with the cult of the saints, which is also not an easy topic to get into, but it's critical if you want to understand the church of the Middle Ages. And so I appreciate that. Tonight we are going to talk about, real briefly, the Crusades, which is, we didn't talk about that last week, right? Or we didn't, okay. So we'll talk briefly about the Crusades, which is one of those, you kind of alluded to it.
I ended up with the other two.
Yeah, you had your hands full. So we'll talk briefly about the Crusades, but then I want to get into more of a broader ranging discussion of the issue of Christians and war. One of the questions that repeatedly showed up on the, I've always wondered, you know, why, back whenever we started this thing, was several of you asked the question, when did Christians start engaging in warfare? When was that okay to do that kind of thing? And so I want to broach that topic tonight. And I know it's kind of dangerous territory, because for some people, that is a very sensitive topic to even raise the question of whether or not it's right or wrong for a Christian to be a soldier. Because maybe they've been in war before, or they have a child that's in the army or whatever, or they're in the National Guard, whatever. It can be sensitive, and I know that. So please don't throw anything at me just for raising the question. I believe that every Christian needs to ask these questions of themselves. When I was in college, this guy almost tried to beat me up over the issue, because I was just raising questions about pacifism and whether or not, and he didn't even want to talk about it. I mean, and he had a crew cut and, you know, whatever, and he was going to be in the Marines, and he was going to pummel me for even suggesting that maybe you should think about it, you know. Anyway, so please don't do that to me tonight. It's just raising the questions. Right. Okay. The Crusades. This is one of the issues that is looms very large in the Christian mind. And if you've got any friends that are anti-Christian, they will raise this question. They'll say, what about the Crusades? What about that? How can Christianity be true if you had this period of time where you had, you know, Christians, you know, beating up on Muslims in the name of Jesus and all this kind of thing?
The Muslim community, this happened yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
The Muslim community now.
Oh.
This Crusades is happening.
Yes. Right. And that's a bigger issue of the Arab mind. Time is, it's not like, you know, oh, let bygones be bygones. They're like, no, my grandchildren will revenge what you just did to me. And I'll be dead and gone, but they'll take care of things, and that's okay. You know, so there's a very long memory in the Arab mind. That's no question about that. And yes, it is very much on the mind of the jihadists today. I mean, Osama bin Laden said there were three reasons why I did what I did. Number one, let's see. You have troops in a Muslim nation, Saudi Arabia. That was number one. What was the second one? I can't remember. But one of them was the Reconquista of Spain, the kicking out of the Muslims out of Spain in 1492. He said, you did that in 1492. And then what was the other one? There was another one. One more that he had mentioned in his initial, you know, after 9/11, saying this is why we did it. And so, very long memory. But at the time, it wasn't that big of a deal, to be honest with you. I'm reading a book right now called The Crusades Through the Arab Eyes. And the book starts off with this point that, you know, at the very beginning, it was happened on the edge of Islam. It wasn't in the heart. I mean, the heart of Islam is in Baghdad, is over in Isfahan, that region over in Iran. And the Crusades were taking place on the fringes. It would be almost like if somebody attacked the very fringe of Alaska, where the heart of America is, Des Moines, Iowa, or something like that. Oh, it's happening out there somewhere, and yeah, we don't like that, and so forth, but it wasn't like at the time it was right at the center. Okay, but over time, it has become this, it looms very large, and is very much in the mind now. A couple things about the Crusades. There are at least four organized Crusades over a long period of time, 250 years of periodic going down to the Holy Land, on an armed pilgrimage. Okay, at least four, there may be up to seven or eight. They kind of, after a while, people said anytime they had an excuse to go fight someone, they would call it a crusade, and then they could, you know, kind of ease their conscience on it. And so, but there are four distinct ones. The only one that was actually very successful was the First Crusade. They actually took Jerusalem, okay, in 1099. But the political background is important to realize. There were a lot of things going on in 1071. The Muslims, Seljuk Turks, had conquered the Byzantine army in the Battle of Manzikert and really scared the Byzantines, thinking that Constantinople could fall any time. And so Alexius Comnenus, who's the emperor of the Byzantines at the time, asked for help from the Western Christendom and asked them to come help out because they thought that they might fall any time. So there's a political background. As Dan talked about last week, shortly before the Crusades happened, there was a split between the Latin Church in the West and the Greek Orthodox Church in 1054, where they excommunicated one another, right? They said, you're excommunicated. No, you're excommunicated. And it kind of a split. And so there was this desire on the part of the Pope to try to, you know, bring things back together. There's also the social background in Europe at the time. They had kind of a mini population boom in the 11th century, and you had a lot of young men with nothing to do, okay? And that's never a good thing, right? You know, I was at the Croc Center today, and I was thinking, this place is jammed full. And why? Because it's holiday time. We don't want these kids out on the street just running around, right? Because they do bad things, vandalize stuff. And same thing in the Middle Ages. There was an abundance of males who were of the noble class that didn't have a fief, didn't have a benefice, their own lands. And so, what are you going to do? You're not going to go into the monastery. There's only so much room there, and you don't want to necessarily go into the church. And so, they were fighting one another. In fact, when Pope Urban calls for a crusade at Clermont, which is what this painting is, in France, the Pope calls the nobles there together and says, hey, why don't you take all that energy that you have and go use it in a good direction, which is to fight Muslims and take back the Holy Land for Christianity. So there's all kinds of political and social backgrounds to this. It was not just a religious episode, although the religion played a pretty big role. There was an upswing of religious devotion in the 11th century as well, and people wanted to do something for their faith. And this was a way, especially the noble classes, could do something physical for God, okay, that they kind of liked to do anyway, which was to fight. All right. So Urban II will call for this crusade, and the famous phrase, God wills it, is what was used. Pope Urban gives this speech in which he is kind of suggesting that they go on crusade, and the crowd that you see here in this picture kind of called out, Deus vult, God wills it. And then he says, well, God must will it. Okay, and so this was one of the battle cries that they made when they were on crusade, God wills it, God wills it. Okay. And today we would probably say this is one of those examples of discerning the will of God. Most Christians would say that was a mistake, right? A big one. So, okay, so that's some of the background of the crusade. Any questions about the backgrounds or comments before we move on to some more specific things about it, the crusades? What have you heard about the crusades, or what's out there in the common mindset about the crusades that you think is important?
It's an oxymoron to call anything a holy war.
Okay. That it's an oxymoron to call something a holy war?
Yeah.
Okay. There is no such thing.
Yeah.
Have you heard the suggestion that the Muslims actually learned the concept of jihad from the Christian crusaders? That one is kind of out there a little bit. It's definitely the other way around, but that I have heard that out in the stream a little bit. Yeah, jihad is part of in the early days of Islam, so it would be hard to make that argument. But yeah, Tom.
I would point out that in almost every major conflict in Western culture, both sides claim the blessing of God. It isn't unique to the Crusades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Both sides want to have divine approval of what they're doing.
Well, they think they have.
Yeah, right. Yeah?
Something that is kind of common to our culture is to say Christianity, or we as Americans ourselves, are responsible for every ill that happens.
Mm-hmm.
AIDS being one of them. That it was a great money grab, and it really wasn't quite that. And they were fighting in response to a plea.
Yes.
With Christian brothers. And they were fighting a violent expansionist empire.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that's some very good points. Yeah, if it was just about the money grab, I think they've done some research on these barons and nobles that went down there. They most of them came back poorer than when they went. It cost them a whole lot of money to do this.
And war has always been costly.
Yeah, but this is their personal fortune they're putting on the line to go do something that they thought was for God. Now they might have thought that a side benefit would be that they could get some plunder, which you always want if you're a medieval knight. But, they didn't come back rich, and many of them didn't come back at all. So, you wouldn't want to forget the true, I think I would say, misguided religious devotion that was part of it. Okay. And that gets us to the next point, which is to understand the Crusades, you've got to understand that it is a pilgrimage. It is a journey, it is a spiritual journey. You're going to a specific place, excuse me, where you believe that you are going to find spiritual blessing when you get there. Okay? Pilgrimage, it was one of the popular ways of expressing your religiosity in the Middle Ages, where you would go to some special site that has some religious significance. You would pray there. You would get as close as you can to holy things. And what are those holy things called?
Relics.
Okay, relics. And what's a relic?
It's an artifact of religious significance. Say,
okay.
For instance, the actual robe of Jesus, the cross, something Jesus had touched, the cup.
Okay.
The bench he sat on. I mean, this goes on.
Yes.
I actually had, as Dan was talking about this, I had a trailing thought that I might interject here. I've often wondered why we don't have any known relics. There certainly were a number of them available. One of the most important set would be the original manuscripts of the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have them.
Right.
If we did have them, imagine what the reaction of Christians would be to a relic of that stature.
Yeah,
and I don't think it would be good. I think it'd be overblown and twisted and warped. People would kill each other under ownership of it.
Yeah.
Well,
they did so over things that were not really relics.
Yes.
So if they really were the genuine item, you can imagine.
And I spent the afternoon today out at the Air and Space Museum in McMinnville, and they have there several relics, if you will. One is a Titan II missile, an actual missile that isn't armed and that isn't fueled. It's the real deal.
Huh.
And it's quite an attraction. Of course, the Spruce Goose is the big attraction. And so people will go look at these things and spend a lot of time and money on them, want to possess them.
Right.
And one would easily imagine start bringing their sick to touch the relic, to be healed.
Yeah,
I mean, it would become quite twisted.
Yeah, and that's definitely what has happened. Even as I said, with the things that are phony, right? People do that. Yeah,
the things we talk about, you can't kind of separate it from the saints.
Mm-mm.
The cult of the saints is the relics, and made the point that one of the more famous relics that's intact today is the head of John the Baptist.
Right, yeah.
Which currently resides in six different churches.
Right. Yeah, we're going to see a clip. We're going to see a clip from a movie.
There is the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem.
Right.
And the Greek Orthodox and the Western Church co-own it. And it is quite a struggle for these two groups to get along with each other.
Mm.
And of course, they don't know that that's even the right place.
Right, yeah.
But that's an example of something kind of minor, if you will.
Imagine yeah.
if we had some major real relics.
Right. Okay, so we understand the idea of a relic, a piece of bone, a skull. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. And by the way, most of the churches of the Middle Ages, underneath the altar, there's supposed to be a relic, okay? And that's, I believe, still true today in the Roman Catholic Church. I don't know if they do that with new churches or not, but there's supposed to be under the altar a relic of some significance. Yeah, Lene.
Isn't it awfully close to idolatry?
Well, yes, I would say so. Although there is a distinction that is made, and you guys probably talked about this last week, between veneration of a relic, which is okay in this point of view, and worship, or you know, something that is a higher level of veneration. You cross a line somewhere. Worship is not okay to anything except for God. Veneration is okay to the saints or to their relics. But as you said, the average person probably crosses that line. The peasant doesn't know the difference. They get down and worship this piece of bone the same way they would something else. So, and there are all kinds of relics. I mean, by the time the late Middle Ages come around, you got vials with the Virgin Mother's milk in it and stuff like that floating around. And actually in the Middle Ages, there's a funny story in the days of Charlemagne they would steal relics. You would go to Rome because there's more there than anywhere else, like saints and people who had died and whatever, and they were buried. And so people would go, and let's say you're from some little parish up in the north of France, and you got some noble who's wanting to build a church. Well, you got to have a relic. Why do you want a good one? And so you'd send people, and they'd steal them. You know, they'd just go into a church and grab them, take off, you know, with this stuff. And there's a great story of Charlemagne's biographer, Einhard, tells the story. It's called The Translation of the Bones of St. Marcellus or somebody like that. And he tells the story of sneaking in and stealing the stuff and going. If you're into that, you ought to read that. It's really interesting. But anyway, we're getting off here a little bit. But the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is the church. This was the highest, the most important pilgrimage site in the medieval world. This was the place, the church where Jesus was laid, where he was for 3 days, the tomb where Jesus lay, okay? And that was where you wanted to go. And there were Christian pilgrims who went there, you know, at least as early as the 11th century, because I think around the year 1022, there was an incident where the Muslims didn't allow the Christians to go visit the pilgrimage site. And this was one of the problems that had come back to the West. People were saying, they're not letting us visit the sepulcher, and this is horrible, and so forth and so on. Usually they would. They would just, these pilgrims here in the white, the Muslims were more than happy for them to come down and visit. They just charged them taxes, you know, like a fare, you know, like a fee. And they're, hey, yeah, come on, you know, take a look at things. And they would charge them. But there was a kind of a disruption of that, which caused some of the religious upset, them to be upset. Okay, so the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and this is actually what it looks like today. Okay, now the Crusaders, once they conquered Jerusalem, they built a church over the sepulchre, right? And again, we don't know for sure that's where he was, but this is the church that supposedly is built over the top of the actual sepulchre where Jesus was placed. The question I would like to raise is pilgrimage biblical? Is the idea of going to a space, a particular space that is going to give you some spiritual benefit, is that something scriptural? There's some basis for that.
Yes, there is.
What's the basis?
The bones of Elijah.
Okay, the bones of Elijah.
Remember, Elijah was dead and buried, and they threw a dead man in the tomb in a hurry, and he came to life?
Oh, okay, so
that is part of the basis.
Okay, so that would be more of a biblical basis for the idea of the relics having some power.
That would be a good basis. You just
right. Okay, let me rephrase the question. Is there any positive kind of, hey, pilgrimage can be a good thing, going to Jerusalem?
Well, I think as a Christian, our pilgrimage is a lifelong pursuit, as it's reflected in the Hebrews leaving Egypt and traveling to the land of Canaan,
mm-hmm.
Also our pilgriming from this world to heaven.
Okay.
In a way, that's kind of our pilgrimage, but it's not something we do several times in our lifetime. It's something we do through our life.
Right. More of a spiritual pilgrimage, not going to a specific place. Right. But in the Old Testament, there was there not a, I will go up to Jerusalem
concept? Yeah, that was a required part of their religious service.
Yeah.
To read the Psalms of Ascent.
Yeah, the Psalms of Ascent are all about, these are the songs you sing as you go up into Jerusalem, which is where the Holy of Holies is, right? The temple is there, and so, yeah, it's a special place. Right. Cheryl, were you just going to point out that?
I was just going to be facetious that we pilgrimage to the closet for prayer.
Okay, yeah. Which can be hard to get to sometimes, you know, if you have too many shoes in there or whatever. But, okay, what are you going to say, Ethan?
Oh, I was thinking about the wise men coming to Jesus' birth.
Okay. They definitely travel to come to a place.
Well, there are multiple opportunities every year to visit the Holy Lands with one group or another.
Mm-hmm.
We had a series here on Sunday night of film clips of a group that were there, and they would go to these different sites and they would talk about them,
right,
connected to the scripture. There's a lot of people who appreciate a visit to the holy, and I put that in quotation lands, because it makes them feel closer.
So right.
I think there's a human tendency in this direction.
Okay. Somebody back there had their hand up there. Yeah, Bill?
Well, I mean, some people could reach back to character Joseph, Egypt to the
Promised Land. Okay.
That's kind of a relic and a pilgrimage, so everything rolled into one.
Right.
And just thinking back into the early ages here, I mean, didn't have scripture to read.
Right.
And I'm sure that a lot of stuff was taken out of the Old Testament, so they're kind of geared towards what they. Stories and things happened there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And a lot of these things in the Middle Ages that you see in the church, I mean, the priesthood and so forth, these are all things that are kind of taken over from the Old Testament Levitical priesthood, the Old Testament regulations, and kind of baptized and kind of made into kind of a Christian kind of sense. And I think the pilgrimage concept comes from that. If you look at the New Testament, you don't really see a lot of this. In fact, you see the idea that Jesus says to the woman at the well, you know, there is a time coming and now is here when you will not come to this place or that place to worship, but those who want to worship God will worship Him in spirit and truth. Which seems to kind of sweep away this idea of holy space, which is what pilgrimage is all about. Okay? Now, I think Tom is right in that there is something that we might still, even in our modern scientific age, say there's something about going to the Holy Land that will make you feel closer to God, but that's more on our side, not necessarily God's side. Okay. Let me move on here because I need to, we don't want to tarry too much on this. We do this, right? We do this. How many of you have been to see the Lincoln Memorial? Okay. Next time you go, think about pilgrimage. That is an American pilgrimage site. People shuffle in there. Ooh, you know, it's calm. If that's not a Greek temple, I don't know what is. When you're walking toward it in these columns, and I mean, it looks like if you expect to see Athena in there or something, you know? I mean, it really is. That's what it's based on. And people shuffle in there, and if you're talking too loud, somebody's going to slap you, you know. And it's a solemn place. Look at all of those monuments like that there. We still feel that. And then if you're a Texan, of course,
yeah,
on the left, you're not truly a Texan until you've gone there and you've kind of, you know, touched the side of the Alamo or one of those kinds of things, right? Anybody Texan here besides Tom? Melody's a Texan, so I give her a hard time. I got two Texans in my three in my family.
I've been there for years. Does that make us Texan?
Not really. You have been, okay. Yeah, they invite foreigners to come there, you know. They allow foreigners to go see the Alamo, people from the other 49. So no, I guess that there's a great King of the Hill episode about going to the Alamo too, if you guys know what King of the Hill is. Okay, so about this. But it really is true, and there is still that sense that of going someplace makes a difference. And look around for relics there, too. When you go to, and you see, oh, here's a clipping of Lincoln's hair. Ooh, you know. And if you go to the Ford's Theater, it's still there. You can see where Lincoln was shot. Right there is where he was shot. We watched a play there a couple years ago. It was kind of fun. But down below during the intercession, there was intermission. There's a museum. It had all these locks of his hair that were cut, and people were stealing them. Even when he was laying there dead, he just died, an hour or so early, and people sneak in there, cut it off and stuff, and take it. I mean, this is after the scientific revolution and after the Enlightenment, and there's still, this has a power over the human psyche, I think. But let's watch this little clip here. Here's a 5-minute clip from the movie Luther. How many of you have seen the movie Luther? Okay. It's a great film. It's obviously set in the 16th century, but the whole idea of pilgrimage and all that is still very much around. In fact, that's one of the things that's being revolted against by the reformers, by the humanists, Christian humanists. And this is a scene where Luther is a monk. Notice his haircut. Okay, you'll see the tonsure. He is going on pilgrimage to Rome because he is losing his faith, and his senior at the monastery says, "You need to go to Rome." And what he does is he goes to Rome on pilgrimage. And when you go on a pilgrimage, you don't just go and kind of, take pictures, even if you could in the Middle Ages. What you do is you do particular things. Okay. This is a scene that shows some pilgrims coming to Rome. Oh, these were the scala sancta. These are supposedly the steps on which Jesus stood when Pilate condemned him.
Okay.
And they were brought from Jerusalem over to Rome. I can't remember when it supposedly happened or whatever, but that's what they are, a relic.
Okay.
You don't have to go to Jerusalem. They're right here. So. Okay, and according to the movie, you know, this, the idea is that Luther, he goes there on pilgrimage, but it doesn't do anything for him spiritually. And he kind of wads up the indulgence, which was going to release his uncle from purgatory when he got to the top of the stairs. And the movie kind of indicates that this is kind of when he had his turning point. We don't really know that from the sources. It looks like it came later on. But this probably did play a role in what he saw there. He wasn't impressed with Rome. When he came back, he was like, if that's the highest I get in Christendom, I might just chunk this thing. So, anyway, we'll come back to Luther later on, but I think that scene helps you understand the idea of pilgrimage. And when you talk about the Crusades, these guys are going on an armed pilgrimage. They're going down to the holy city, and to get there, they're going to be conquering and fighting and killing the Muslim rulers of the area, okay? And they're going to try to take back that territory and let it be ruled by Christians once again. And, you know, this is one of those, you know, areas that, they finally will be successful, and they take the city of Jerusalem in 1099. They take off in 1096. They go all the way down there. Four armies basically converge, and they travel down together. They have a lot of difficulties along the way, but eventually they do take Jerusalem, and it is a bloodbath. 2 days of slaughter, men, women, children, Jews, Christians, whoever was there defending the city. There were actually Jews and Christians fighting against they called them the Franks. Okay, the Frange in Arabic, because they don't know who these guys are. Yeah, they've got a cross. We recognize that, but they talk differently. They're speaking this French language thing. Their priests don't dress like our priests, and so they're fighting. All they know is that they're an invader, and they're fighting against them. And so there's a big slaughter. Some of the chronicles say that you know, the blood flowed, you know, ankle deep throughout the streets of Jerusalem. You know. And the last few Muslim survivors were forced to take the bodies and throw them out into the ditch. And then after they finished taking the bodies out in the ditch, they killed them and threw them in the ditch. Okay, and it was a really bloody mess. But I think it's also telling that once the carnage was over, just imagine these medieval Germanic nobles who've come all this way. They've got blood all over them because they just slaughtered all these people, and they find their way to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and they get down on their knees and they start crying and weeping that they've come to this holy of holy places. So it's kind of a twisted kind of spirituality, but it was a religious thing for them to do. Okay. So the First Crusade is successful. They will set up basically Christian kingdoms in the Middle East. And then after about 50 years, the Muslims finally get their act together. They were politically divided themselves, and so they were fighting amongst themselves. And they will fight against the Christians, overthrow them. The news gets back to Europe. And then there's a call for another crusade. So the Second Crusade comes down, and it's kind of successful for a little while. And then they run into trouble. Then there's another call for crusade, and people come down. Richard the Lionheart, for example, and Frederick Barbarossa, some of the famous ones. The Robin Hood time period is the Third Crusade. So, but the First Crusade is really the only one that's very, very successful in terms of taking land. So, okay. The big issue that I think the Crusades raises that we haven't got to yet in this class, I want to take the last few minutes to talk about it, is Christians in war. It raises the question, you know, can Christians, should Christians, when did Christians begin to engage in war? And as far as I can tell, there are basically three positions that you can take. One is the pacifist position. The other is the crusader position. And the third is the just war position. And I want to talk briefly about each of these three and just kind of get the themes out there. The first one is pacifism. The idea is that Christians are not of this world. And if there's anything that is of this world, it's bloodshed and violence and hatred and, you know, fighting and killing other human beings. Okay? And so pacifists completely reject all forms of coercion, physical coercion of another human being. And obviously that includes a rejection of war as well. Some hardcore pacifists would even say that a Christian cannot serve as a policeman, for example, who's going to use violence against somebody someday, right? Going to spill blood, perhaps. Okay, but not all pacifists would be in that position. So, but that's the basic idea. And the biblical support for this point of view, you know, you could look at Matthew 5. If you got your Bible, we could turn to a couple of these passages. Anybody know what Matthew 5, 38 is all about? I'll read it. Matthew 5, 38, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. And then probably more important to that than that one is verse 43. You've heard it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven, and so forth. And so they would point to this passage, Matthew 26 as well, verse 52.
Peter,
I'm sorry?
Is that Peter, I
think? No, this is close to there. It's when Jesus is arrested. And in verse 52, you know, Peter, well, let's see. One of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Is that what you're talking about? Okay. And then Jesus says in verse 52, put your sword back in its place. Jesus said to him, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. And one of the common refrains that you hear in the pacifist writers, especially of the first few centuries, is that when Jesus told that, it would have been Peter, right? Put that sword back. He sheathed the sword for all Christians. Okay, so that's the pacifist position. There is biblical New Testament. You could make arguments for this, and all of these you could different interpretations of what exactly Jesus meant. Okay, but these are the passages that loom large. The Sermon on the Mount. If you find me a pacifist, and I will find you a person who spent a lot of time in the Book of Matthew. Okay, and a lot of time in the Sermon on the Mount, because that is what is very important to them. Okay, historical support. Is before Constantine in the 4th century, and we've talked a lot about Constantine, so you remember who he is. It is probably accurate to say that the majority of Christians were in the pacifist point of view. Okay? That we shouldn't get involved with government, we shouldn't be involved with wars. That's just something that the pagans do, and we don't do that. Okay? Justin Martyr in the 2nd century, around the end of the 2nd century, writes to the emperor and says, hey, we won't fight in your wars, but we pray for you. Okay? The Christians don't fight. And we do more by our prayers than your soldiers do with their swords. And that's a pretty common refrain that we see throughout the pre-Constantinian period. It's only in the 4th century that we see this massive shift to where Christians are saying, it's okay. It's actually good for Christians to be in the army or so forth. Yes, Ron.
You already mentioned earlier that even in the early church that there were no sects that actually sought martyrdom.
Right.
So not only turning the other cheek, but would launch themselves out in front of the sword.
Yeah. Yeah, if they're dealing with the sword, it's on the receiving end. You know, it's on the receiving end. Yes.
Looking at the three, and then we have the other two to look at still, but on the end of this one, you have another way of looking at it is that predominantly Christians were not allowed to serve in the military until the 4th century. And,
well, that's an argument against the pacifist position.
Yeah. And I think on all three positions, you'll find the same thing, that there are... Their own argument sometimes is timely.
Yeah, right. Yeah. What Dan's getting at here... One of the reasons, I mean, there's no question historically that most of them are pacifists in the pre-Constantinian period. But there is a question as to why, you know. Why don't they fight in the armies? Is it because in order to fight, you know, in a Roman legion, you know, what is the guy doing that's in the front of the Roman legion? He's holding this big, long, big standard. And all these pictures of their gods. And before you go to battle, you make a sacrifice. And so was it because it was idolatry that they were opposed to, or was it the bloodshed itself? So that has been one of the questions. And it's hard to be 100% sure on that. But they were against it. And, you know, we just don't know 100% why. Although we have some... It's interesting, even though this is true, there were some stories of Marcus Aurelius' troops actually having some victories because there were Christians in the army. So you kind of have a little bit of contradictory evidence there. Okay, like they even point to him and say, hey, I think it was they got rain or something because there were Christians in his amongst his troops or something. But, okay, so that's the pacifist position. Let's move on to the other one, which is the crusader, which is what we've been talking a little bit about tonight. And that's the idea that a Christian, it's not only okay to wield the sword, but you can go to the next step, which is to actually fight and kill another person to advance the Christian faith in the same way that the crusaders did in the Middle Ages. Okay, defend the faith, but advance the faith as well. Not only is it okay to fight, but you can fight in the name of Christ to take Christianity to the next level. And there is biblical support for this, isn't there? In the Old Testament? I didn't say New Testament. Biblical support. Can you not find... I mean, you guys know the Bible. In the Old Testament, holy war is all over the place, isn't it?
Yeah.
Go conquer the Canaanites. Don't spare anybody. God commanded them to do this kind of thing.
So when God commands it, it's okay.
Exactly. And that's what some of the opponents of crusading have said. Okay, if God were to show up and say, I want you guys all to go fight, so then it would be okay because whatever God says to do is okay. Ipso facto, right? I mean, it just is.
But he did.
When?
Because when the Pope said, go.
He was speaking, yeah, okay.
No, that was pre-papacy.
Infallibility, yeah. Well, I think what Urban would have said was there that God was speaking through the voice of the people who together said, Deus vult, God wants it, God wills it. And you've heard the old adage, you know, the vox populi, vox Deus, you know, the voice of the people is the voice of God, which is really dangerous. Okay, but, in, you know, that may have been what was at play there. Okay, so the Old Testament model, look at Joshua, look at some of these passages where the Lord tells Joshua, go and conquer Jericho and all these other places. Okay, and they would point to that and say, see, they did it in the Old Testament. And, you know, they would also could use the Old Testament, and this brings up a whole other issue that maybe that's not good to get into, is the whole annihilation kind of war. The black flag kind of war. That when we read in the Old Testament, we have to wince, don't we? And kind of move on to something else sometimes. You know, kill them all, let God sort them out, basically. And that makes us uncomfortable, but they would point to some of that. The historical support for a crusading position is after the 4th century. But I will say this, you don't really see a strong crusader mentality until you get to the Middle Ages. Okay, and because in the 4th and 5th century, war is acceptable, but it is more for other reasons. And that is more of the just war concept. It's an unfortunate necessity, but it's not something you necessarily want to go out and do in the name of Jesus, right? Okay, so just war, you guys are probably familiar with this concept, which is war okay for Christians to engage in? Maybe, okay? Only if it is a just war. It is not ethical for a Christian to engage in an unjust war, only a just war. But what does that automatically beg? What question does it beg?
Who decides?
Who decides what's a just war? How do you know what a just war is? And so, basically, Augustine in the 5th century kind of develops some themes in the various parts of his writings that later Christian intellectuals would build upon and create this concept of the just war theory. And so here are some of the things that were considered wars that a Christian could engage in. A defensive war, if you are in a country and, you know, here come the barbarians and That's okay to fight and defend. Okay, punitive for injustices. Go punish a nation that has done something wicked to your nation. Also to restore order. If there's chaos in a situation, bad things almost always happen to innocent people in chaotic, anarchic environments. And so to restore order is considered an ethical thing, even if you have to kill someone in the process to restore order. And then also one of the things that had to be in place in order for a war to be just was that you had to have some chance of success. In the Christian tradition, intellectual tradition regarding war, if it's a suicide mission, it's really not. It's better to do this and try to find some other way to work it out. If you're going to lead people and to their death when there is no chance of success, that's sometimes referred to as an unethical thing to do. Okay, so that's kind of the theory, just cause. But also with the just war theory, it says not only Christians have to be sure that it's a just war, but they also should conduct themselves in a different way than the nations do. And so that's just conduct during war. Only fighting under proper authority. Christian theorists would say that if, you know, Dan decides he's all mad at Osama bin Laden and he buys a ticket to Pakistan and he goes and he tries to find Osama bin Laden on his own authority, that would never be considered a just conduct of war. Because you're fighting under your own authority, you can't be sure that that is just. Proper attitude, ironically, love is supposed to still motivate you even when you're fighting a just war. Anybody get that, or can you see where they're coming from on that? Just war? Okay, you're fighting, you still love that person over there. You have nothing personally against that guy over there on the other side of the trench, and you still would love him, but he is fighting in a wicked way or whatever, and so you're going to actually be loving him with the bayonet, so to speak.
Also, that defensive war, you are actually defending those you love.
Okay, yeah. I think more when it comes to the theorists, though, they're thinking you still need to have, you cannot have personal hatred toward the soldier on the other side. If you do that, then you're not fighting in a just way. I read some sermons from World War I when some preachers were preaching this, and they said, when you stab the Hun with your bayonet, that is loving him because you're delivering him from the tyranny of the Kaiser. So you're supposed to be loving him somehow as you're fighting. And then proper virtues, honesty, mercy, you know, take care of civilians and so forth. If you make a deal with the guy under the white flag, you're supposed to honor it. Some of these things that you're familiar with kind of from UN in Geneva Convention types of things, those all stem from Christian concepts of just war. If it wasn't for the Christian tradition, we wouldn't have laws of warfare today. Okay? It would just be whatever, you know? And that's one of the things that the broader world owes to the Christian tradition. Yeah, Lene?
Just a basic question. Where does the commandment, thou shalt not kill, does that come into all this? Does that mean murder? Does that mean, where does that
yeah. Those in the just war that would argue that just war is the right way to look at things would say that, you know, the commandment, the sixth commandment, right? Yeah, would say that that is murder and that that is not at all relevant to the discussion of war. Okay? Because there's all kinds of killing in the Old Testament that is okay. You know, even execute capital punishment is okay. So, you know, the sixth commandment has to do with murder.
Another argument that supports this is a negative. There is no instruction in the New Testament for soldiers to resign.
Right.
But there is for them to do a good job.
Yes.
Right. And that's one of the points here on biblical support. They would point to the centurion's faith. The centurion is brought in, but he's not told that he has to resign, you know, from his commission. Maybe he was. We don't know. You know, we just, I think it was Jesus who tells, was it John? The soldiers come to John and want to be baptized, right? And he says, go and be fair with your tax collection and so forth. Now, the pacifist would argue that he was just basically a policeman, which is okay. I think, you know, from Romans 13, this is where I personally would make the argument that Romans 13 seems to indicate that God has ordained the state for its existence, because in man's sinful state, if you don't have government, people are just going to go berserk on one another.
You have chaos.
You have chaos, which is more evil than having the sword, that the governor bears that sword not in vain. He does it for some good. And, you know, it just seems to me that if God is going to ordain the state, then He has also ordained the use of the sword by the state as doing some good in the world. Okay? Now, my pacifist friends tell me, well, wait a minute. That's for the world. That's for unregenerate people. And yes, God can do some good things through them. But that's still not our mission. So we should stay away from that. But I can't go with them on that. But anyway, you can see these are the three basic positions. And each of them has merit. And I know I'm going over, but I've been gone for 3 weeks, so I'll just try to wrap it up here real quick. Which of them is correct? Pacifism? The crusader? The just war? Is there one we can throw out? Like, kind of obvious? That one's not good? Okay, can we all agree? We can throw out the crusader, right? All right, so that really kind of leaves us with the pacifist view, the just war. What's that?
Your willingness to throw any of them out, doesn't that depend more on when you live?
Okay, yeah, I mean, perhaps, but I will point out that there were some people in the Middle Ages who said, that's not right. The crusader position is not right, even though there were others who, you know, Martin Luther will argue against crusader position very strongly. So, but I think, you know, on the balance, if you're going to take Christ and a proper understanding of the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, and the New Covenant, we can throw a crusader out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think all of us would, most of us would fit into either one of these two categories. I hope one of the things to keep in mind is that both of them have problems. With the pacifist point of view, you're left with this nagging suspicion that we're naive in the world. And it's just going to be nice and loving to people, and bad people are just going to come over to your side. And so you're going to let evil triumph in the world.
Well, that would be my concern with the pacifism point of view would be, well, okay, who is protecting me then?
God.
God is protecting me spiritually, but who's protecting me?
Well, they would say God as well.
To continue God's...
That's up to him.
They would argue that physical protection isn't important.
It is if you want to pass his word on.
They would say that that's not important.
Right, yeah.
But... you have to be here to pass His word.
No, God will take care of those.
Yeah, he'll figure it out. I mean, they would also point to say, hey, how did the church grow so much?
Be here.
during the days of persecution, how did the church grow so much when they were all pacifists?
Okay. That is their position.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I would say at one time in my life, I was a pacifist, and I kind of changed my point of view. But there's also problems with the just war theory, because it easily can turn into a crusader, it can turn into, you know, something bad.
It still comes down to somebody saying it is just.
Yeah. Exactly. And so here's one of the reasons it's hard, and I know I'm really pushing it here, but I can't leave this. The problem with the just war theory is this. Ask yourself, which of the American wars was an unjust war? Don't answer that. Don't answer that. Most American Christians will say, none of them. All of them are just, of course. So you end up justifying yourself retrospectively, okay? And that's the problem. The other problem is that even in our society, our liberal American society, you do not have an individual choice. You cannot join up to the military and then say, oh, I'll fight in Afghanistan, but not in Iraq, because Afghanistan's a just war, Iraq's not a just war. Guess what? They throw you in the brig for that, or the guy up in Tacoma, he's going through that right now. Once you join up, you know, you're under their control. So the pacifists say, you can't get involved at all because you're going to eventually be forced to fight in an unjust war if your country takes you that direction.
If that is the case, and I don't mean to interrupt, but if the case is to not consider it the Revolutionary War, we would still be under rule of England.
And drinking tea rather than coffee?
Right.
Okay. Well, what's wrong with that? Okay. No, just kidding. All right, that really opens up a hell of a can of worms.
That's a point, because you don't know who's on the other side. In World War II, roughly 80% of the German soldiers that our side killed on the battlefield were not Nazi, they were Lutheran.
And right, yeah, okay. Yeah.
There's no way around that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so there are difficulties with all of these, and I think each individual Christian is going to have to really wrestle with them, but I just encourage you, it's a good thing to do, to wrestle with this question, because it actually, you're asking yourself the question, do I really trust God? Has God ordained the state? Okay, what role is the state? Is it wrong to kill? Those are all important issues for every Christian to be asking, and sometimes we don't ask those enough. Last point, Ron, and then I'll wrap this up.
I would say each Christian needs to be convinced in their own heart. And if it gives your conscience and you do it, I think you're in violation of God's will for you.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a flexibility there that He allows the individual to wrestle with.
Right.
And I don't think that you can come down on one side or the other and say it applies to everyone.
Right. Good point. And it is one of those things where we leave it up to our own individual judgment. I'll point out, before I close though, this is one of the things that always gets people, is the great theorists about just war would say that the individual does not have the right to ever bear the sword on their own authority. Okay? Somebody breaks into your house, you don't have the right to blow them away. Because you cannot be sure that you're doing that under your right. You're not under the right authority. You got to call the cops to do that, which is ironic because that's one of the arguments that's always made. What are you going to do if somebody breaks in your house? I'll blow them away. You know, whatever. That supports the just war theory. Well, Augustine and others said specifically, no, you don't, because you may be hating them in your heart, and that's, you know, that's bad. The soldier doesn't hate; he just does what he's told to do, type of thing. Anyway, maybe I shouldn't have brought that up at the very end, but anyway.
And another point.
Anyway, now. We can deal with that some more next week if you...